Welcome everyone to another episode of the iSci Flyby Show.
Today's show is Living in Space, Part 1. So to launch our great new podcast, we'll be looking at perhaps the most exciting prospects any of us could imagine. A vision of billions of people living their lives in huge space colonies, revolving in space around gas giants such as Jupiter and Saturn. It's 2001 A Space Odyssey, with large organisations in both the UK and the USA actively planning such monster habitations at this very moment.
Thanks, Olivia. To help us get a grasp of this stunningly exciting issue, we've got two guests who have devoted a good part of their lives to studying and writing about it, Stephen Ashworth and Mark Hemsall. Both are fellows of the prestigious British Interplanetary Society. Stephen has published on space colonies and is currently involved in a proposed development called Planetopolis. Mark is an expert on space colonies. He's working on near-term spaceship designs, one of them is called the Scorpion, and is the current editor of the BIS magazine called Spaceflight. Okay, enough blah. Let's get straight into this incredible subject. Okay, welcome Stephen and Mark, and many thanks for giving us your time. One of the things that's been puzzling me about living in space is that we've had the space station up there, the International Space Station, now for, about 20 years? And the space station weighs about, 460 tons and is about the size of a football pitch. So how would that compare to the sorts of colonies that you're talking about in your articles?
Shall I start with that? Because that's a real rabbit hole to go down. the colonies that we would be talking about in their mature form, I think there may be some sort of lead ups to it, but in their mature form, these colonies will be something like 4 kilometres, 5 kilometres in diameter. They will be, but again, probably 5 to 6 kilometres high. They will be the size of a medium-sized city, you know, a few million people living in that sort of population density.
Wow, that is big.
Yeah, so that is your orbital space colony you're talking about, just to be clear.
Yes, sorry, yeah. And again, this is maybe something that Steve and I would like to start with. My view is that's how people will live in space. It's so much better living in those circumstances than any planetary surface that we could make. So you'll visit planets to get materials, to science, just for holidays and things. But I think where people will live will be these orbital cities.
Does Stephen agree with you there?
My impression is that living on a planetary surface is easier, or at any rate, construction on a planetary surface will be easier because you have all the materials to hand, you have a surface to work on, and you have gravity to hold things in place. For example, a colony on Mars would come first, but in the long run, certainly I agree with Mark that colonies in actual orbital space will be very important. And in the long term, it's necessary to realise that the amount of space and amount of resources available in space means that there could be a much larger population living in space than on Earth.
I mean, how much larger? Sorry, Olivia, you
carry on. I was just going to say the exact same question.
5 or 6 orders of magnitude.
Are you quoting my paper, Stephen? I have actually written a paper on that very subject. And in Earth orbit, I think we could house at least 10 billion people without too much trouble.
In Earth orbit?
In Earth orbit. It really grows when you get to the outer planets, where you could have hundreds of billions of people living around the outer planets in these colonies.
Wow.
I'll let Olivia take the question about resources then.
Yeah, I was going to say, what kind of cost would that be to build?
Well, certainly the resources are there in that that's part of the paper, was to show that you're only scratching maybe 1% of the available resources at that location to make them. On the economics, they should make economic sense. If you look at a space colony that's about the size of a city, if you can make it for a few hundred billion, then you've made something like a million things you can sell: houses, business premises, utility companies.
Right.
You've got about a million things to sell. If you can sell them for an average of a million each, and that's not outrageous for a good house or a business premises or something, then you've made a trillion. So it could actually be very profitable to essentially make new cities and then sell them.
Well, who would pay the initial costs is the main thing.
Somebody who wants to get 20% on their investment. If you think about it, if you've got billions to invest, and there are organisations that have billions to invest, finding things that get better than the base rate as a return that are safe is very difficult to do. It could actually be very attractive for people who've got billions they've got to somehow dispose of in a way that brings in a guaranteed but high return.
Okay, so that stunned everybody. The sheer size of them, the sheer complexity of them, seems to indicate that there's going to be a lot of material, not so much the resources, but a lot of materials to put together. Who's going to do the putting together of all these, this giant colony?
That's an interesting point. They are actually rather simple. They're not. In some respects, they are no more complex in terms of what they're doing than the space station, and indeed may even be conceptually simpler. I think the thing that we don't yet know how to do, because we've never tried, is to do civil engineering in space. At the moment, we're doing aerospace engineering in space. And to make these things, we've got to learn to do civil engineering, which is the way we make buildings, the way we make bridges, the way we make dams. And that's the new thing. It's not that we have to have some fancy new technology. We have to know how to organize and successfully engineer large, simple things that we make cheaply for something like $1,000 per ton, something like that.
The way I can see this, I mean, we're talking about a huge piece of kit that's bigger than anything we've ever built on the planet Earth.
Not quite. No.
It's
in the same scale. It's in a similar scale to bridges, dams. The smaller colonies are probably the equivalent of supercargo carriers, supertankers, world ships, that sort of thing.
Okay. Then, assuming that the resources are out there, and I assume what you're talking about here is planetary and asteroid resources that we can mine and then refine, is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Exactly. But where are the factories going to be to make all these girders and plates and steel bits and pieces?
That's an interesting point and part of not knowing the answer. Do you make them where you're making the material and ship the processed parts? Or do you send the raw material to the production site and make the factories are at the colony and maybe become part of the colony at the end of the day?
I mean, in theory, what we're talking about here is how many million tons of stuff to make one colony? 18 kilometres long and 4 kilometres across?
Not 18 long. I think that's a bit long. There's actually some maths that's recently been done that shows that you're going to have roughly this 4 or 5 kilometres, and if you go bigger, you start getting less efficient. And the height of the cylinder, if you imagine it's a baked bean can, 4 kilometres, and you're going to have something like 3 kilometres high.
That's a huge amount of steel and materials.
And I think it will be steel.
A mass of 10 million tonnes per person for 10,000 people, so 1,000 tonnes per person.
Yeah,
1,000 tons.
Oh, my
so
Lord.
So let's put this in perspective from today's point of view, because the biggest rockets we've got can lift around about 150 tons. And that's probably only into low Earth orbit. I don't know whether that would get to geostationary.
It is low Earth orbit.
It is low Earth orbit, and we don't yet have a rocket and do 150 tons. At the moment,
Well, SpaceX is getting very close.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah. I won't say they've done it till they've done it. but Saturn V was 100 tons. But yes, if we push it, we can easily get 100 ton plus payload rockets. Yeah.
So to get 1,000 tons out there to these colonies, it's going to take...
That's why you don't do it from the Earth. You do it from the moon.
Exactly.
So
the factories would be better off out there, wouldn't they?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you certainly don't have the factory on the surface of the Earth.
No, absolutely not, no. I mean, that's part of the point, is we stop industrializing the Earth. We start moving the industrial activity that is incompatible with our biosphere off to somewhere where it's not harming our biosphere. That, you know, that's the starting point of why you'd want to do it.
So you're playing the ecological card as well.
That's always been the case. Stephen, again, probably will have even more to say on that.
It sounds unbelievable, but somehow it is believable, because humans have always pushed the boundaries and have always done things that are quite amazing.
Excuse me, it's a consequence of a particular view, namely that growth and progress will continue, material growth and progress, which is opposed to the view that a lot of people have, that growth and progress must come to an end. If it continues, then it will continue out in the solar system, and we will build living space for huge numbers of people off planet.
Okay, so what you're saying, I think, is that growth and progress will actually end on planet Earth, but begin again out in space.
Yeah, if I can quote, and I don't know if I'm quoting myself or Bob Parkinson, because although Bob Parkinson put it in his book, he credited it with me, and I can't remember saying it. But the choice that humanity currently has is between a space age and a stone age. And there's no middle option.
Yeah, that would seem pretty stark.
Can I say that I agree with that, and that the way that I put it when I write articles is that the human future will look either like Star Trek or it will look like Game of Thrones.
Well, that's quite a future to behold.
Oh, yeah. He knows he's pressing one of my buttons. Star Trek is not a good guide to what space will be like.
It's just the general atmosphere of technological progress, confidence.
Now, being a scientist, Olivia's got some questions, I think, about radiation. But before she does do that, I've got a question about gravity. How will you simulate gravity on these things? I mean, from my point of view, gravity is the one thing that makes the space colonies a good option, as opposed to living on another planet, which will mean lower gravity and all the rest of it. So how will gravity be simulated?
Shall I take that one? it's simple. You just slowly spin the cylinder. And by slowly, you're talking about once a minute to once every 1.5 minutes. And that will give you 1G at the cylinder surface. And that is,
in
the inside, yeah.
Yeah.
And this is why living in one of these colonies, it will be indistinguishable from living in an Earth city, except the weather will be better. And if you look up, and no one in the city ever looks up, the sky will look different. That's it.
Because the sky will actually be the other side of the cylinder, presumably.
Yes.
Right.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah. So we've read a lot about that sort of stuff in the science fiction writers, and that's something that people are fairly used to thinking about. But actually, planning something like this, thinking about it, getting the maths together for it, and so on, is very new, isn't it?
Stephen, do you want to explain 1970s and O'Neill?
The first serious studies were undertaken by Gerard O'Neill in the 1970s.
Wow.
But the ideas go back all the way to Tsiolkovsky at the beginning of this century.
1910, to be accurate.
Thank you. I think he speculated about having greenhouses in space to support people living there.
And spinning.
Thank you.
And his greenhouses had trees in them, so they're not little greenhouses.
Yeah. I can see Olivia's just dying to get in with her question, but can I just ask one more? And that is that if they're going to spin these things, don't people get dizzy?
Not at the spin rates we're talking about of once a minute or once every 1.5 minutes.
So there's no Coriolis force or anything?
There is a Coriolis force, but it's below what upsets the human ear. It's actually not known how fast you can spin people in space without them getting sick. On the ground, it tends to be between once every 30 seconds to once every 40 seconds. People differ. But right. In space, the inner ear goes funny anyway, so we don't know. But the way these colonies are turning out, that you'd want to spin them slower than that, once a minute, once every 1.5 minutes, that sort of speed.
Right.
And even on the Earth, people could take that sort of spin rate without inner ear upset.
Like on a Ferris wheel?
Yeah, that's much faster.
Yeah.
Yes, I see what you're saying, yes.
So, of course, one of the predominant factors of space is just how dangerous the radiation can be. So in terms of, especially when you've got members of the public, how on earth would you protect from the radiation around these sorts of stations, including transporting people to and from?
Okay. Stay with me here. What you do, there may be ways to use electromagnetic fields and things to improve the radiation environment, but you can just do it with material, just the same way we do on the Earth. The reason we have a radiation environment on Earth is because at sea level, we've got 10 tons of air above us. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, exactly how much protection we need is a great unknown, but let's say it's something in the order of 7 to 10 tons of material per square meter of radiation protection to give you the same sort of radiation protection that we have on Earth.
Okay. Right.
Yeah. Right. Now, this is where that 2 kilometer thing comes from. You have that radiation protection underneath you on the ground. The walls of the cylinder have to have that aerial density, that number of tons per square meter. As you expand out, the thickness of steel that you need to support the pressure gets thicker.
Mm.
Right. At some point, the steel is thick enough to provide the radiation protection that you need without any additional shielding.
Right.
And that maths gives you a radius of 2 kilometers, which is where the 4 kilometers diameter comes from. That's the point at which the material you're investing in the pressure vessel equals the material you need for radiation protection. If you go bigger than that, you need more material for the structure than you need for radiation protection.
Oh, wow.
So it starts becoming more expensive to build them, whereas at that point, if you go smaller, you need less structural material, but then you have to make it up for the radiation protection. So you've always got this 7 tons or 10 tons or wherever you want to set it. You've got that as a fixed amount up to the point where the structural material equals that amount, and then they start becoming more weight inefficient to make.
So to put it mildly, what you're saying is if you could build them that big and get enough materials and resources to create the steel to create that sort of cylinder, people would be as safe on these things as they would be on Earth.
Yes.
Almost as if it's a passive thought, the radiation protection, because the structural will cover it for you.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
There's
a smaller colony idea that the guys from the British Interplanetary Society came up with, their Avalon concept, is where it was a smaller colony, so it hadn't reached that point. So they had the structural cylinder rotating one direction, and then they used the radiation shielding as an outer sort of shielding cylinder that they rotate the other direction, so they can then have neutral spin. They can spin it up by spinning the other thing the other way around.
I think I'm lost for a start. So there's two objects spinning inside each other?
Yes, it's like a Russian doll. The inner doll is the pressure vessel with where you're living, and then the outer doll is a shield that spins and counter spins. So that's how you spin the thing up.
And that gets it, presumably the double spin gets it stable in some way, does it?
Yes, there's an awful lot of angular momentum. You've got huge masses. Mm. You've got so yes, it does. How you spin them up is an issue. and if you don't do them by this sort of counterspin route, then you have got a problem if you ever want to de-spin it again.
Just explain that a little bit more, Mark, please.
Well, okay. Let's say you spin it up by consuming enormous amounts of rocket propellant on sort of spin jets. The problem is if you then want to de-spin it, you've got to have all those propellants to de-spin it the other way.
Yeah.
And the quantities are enormous. So I certainly think that's one of the lessons we've learned in the more recent thinking that's come out in the last decade or so, is that you always have a counterweight so you can spin two objects and then you can always de-spin them again.
Because they're less mass?
No, it's because the angular, it's to do with angular momentum. You can't, angular momentum has to be conserved.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, of course. Yeah.
So if you've got essentially the way I've done it in the recent things I've come up with is I have two of these colonies attached to one another and they counter spin against each other.
Right.
Okay. And then if you need to de-spin them, then you can de-spin them. The angular momentum still remains the same because the net angular momentum of the system is zero.
Wow.
Right.
Okay, I'll take that on advisement. I'm sure a lot of people out there want to know what it would be like to actually live in one of these colonies. What would it be like if we were there now, for example?
Well, if we were there now, it would be very simple. We would not notice any particular differences. We'd still be living in houses. We'd still have a roof over our heads most of the time.
And would there be parks to go to and
leisure facilities?
Yeah.
Oh, ideally, yeah. Yes. The ideal way to imagine them is to imagine them as looking very much like, say, the university campus with buildings and parks and all the facilities that you would expect there. The reality may be closer to central Tokyo.
Yeah.
So okay.
How it will actually look depends on, you know, decisions yet to be made and people yet to be born who will design these. But in principle, they could be very nice.
In principle,
they could also be horrible places, and it's up to us to get it right.
Oh, I don't think they will be, for the simple reason that people aren't going to be forced to do these. You've got to make them attractive enough that people will actually want to invest. You know, you're going to buy a house in a colony, it's going to cost you maybe something like $1 million, you know, like a big investment. You're not going to go there if it's not a really good place to bring up your family.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and the guys making these are going to work like crazy to make them ideal places to live.
Yes,
of course.
In the initial stages, but after they've been occupied for a few hundred years, they may not be quite so idyllic.
So we could have slum colonies.
Oh my lord!
Yes, but the good colonies will be on the outskirts of the solar system. So the society as a whole needs to keep on growing.
This is quite interesting, actually, because if you then take that a step further and assuming that the Western colonies will be developed by billionaires who decide to sell and make a profit and occupied by individuals who pay $1 million per house or whatever, what about colonies that might be developed by, I don't know, the Russians or the Chinese or any other socialist state?
The socialist states have proven, well, Russia certainly proved unable to develop high technology beyond a certain point. There are lots of people who are really enthusiastic about what China is doing now. They've landed a robot on the moon. They've landed one on Mars. Now they've got their own independent space station with three astronauts on board. And people are saying that the Chinese are going to send a manned expedition to the moon and they're going to overtake the West. But it remains true that China is a very authoritarian society. It's a dictatorship, basically, under the dictatorship of the Chinese Communist Party. And to those of us who've seen this all before, that people were enthusiastic about the Soviet Union being the society of the future, and then seeing how it turned out, this looks quite familiar. So personally, I'm skeptical that China or Russia will be able to compete in this against basically the US.
I mean, I'd probably agree with you as far as Russia's concerned, but what about China? China is a very, very determined society. When they decide to do something, it gets done. You've only got to look at their activities in the South China Sea and the way they're building up the Chinese Navy and so on to see that when they want to do something.
I'm wondering if we're looking at it politically, and I think it's better to look at it culturally. If I were knocking off colonies, my colony Global Inc., I might be tempted to set up colonies that are Islamic in nature, where the institutions are Islamic or Eastern Chinese in nature. You could even imagine a sort of Taiwan where you've set up a Chinese cultural colony that's free from the Chinese government. So I do see colonies as potentially being culturally diverse, because wherever you have a culture which has people who could afford the living space, it's going to be a better place probably for them to live.
Yeah. But what about conflict? Do you see a situation where there are hundreds of these colonies out there and they fight for resources?
Yes. Yeah.
Being human beings, I suppose.
Yes. I don't know if Stephen has a cheerier view.
I'll pass on that.
All right. Well, let's get back to a more practical.
So there is a point. There's a hidden implication there. Back in the 70s, when these colonies were first announced, so O'Neill, who did them, actually called them islands. He envisioned them as being completely self-contained centres of civilization. And I think he missed the key point that they're actually connected.
Yeah.
It's not that each colony is a little piece of economy in its own right. They're all connected in a wider economy. And I was looking at how difficult it is to get from one colony to another. And although the timescales are quite long, you're talking about flights of days, weeks, maybe even in extreme cases, months.
Right. Yeah.
The energy needed is pathetic. One thing I looked at, I use more energy per kilogram getting myself down to Tesco's for a weekly shop than it took to get from one colony to another. So I think you get back to a sort of pre-air travel world where it's like ocean voyages. You accept that it's going to take you a few weeks to get between colonies.
But they're getting to Australia.
Exactly, yeah.
Still on the subject of transport, we're talking about, 1.5, 1.6 million people per colony?
Yes, that would be about
something like that.
Something like that, yes. Whether you pay special to get a low-density colony and have more parks and things, or whether you go for a sort of Paris-type density, which Paris is a surprisingly dense city.
Yes.
Which you can understand if you've ever been in a Paris hotel. The rooms there are north, absolutely minuscule.
Or on the périphérique.
Yes.
But if you think about that, then you've got 1.6 million people to transport out there. How are they going to get there? The biggest rockets we've got would only carry maybe 100 people.
Well, in the modelling I've done, I've assumed a vehicle called Skylon. I've assumed a special passenger version of it that carries 60 people. And I have models that show that supporting 500 million people in space without any problems. Yeah. Oh, sorry, Stephen is showing your model of Skylon. Actually, I've got the same model just behind me. You have a fleet. If you have a fleet of them that's about half the civil aviation, you can have economic interaction with, as I say, a regime of 500 million people in space. And you are depopulating the Earth as a natural process. There's more people go out than come back.
So the transport doesn't worry you then?
No, not really. That is something we. If you ask me, look, I need a transport system for all these colonies. Give me the money and the team. I'll knock them up for you. We know how to do them.
Right.
That's fantastic.
I'll say, actually, the funny thing is, the difficulty is this civil engineering is actually we've got to learn to do lower technology for building the colonies than we need the high technology for the transport.
So do you see thousands of astronauts all dressed up in spacesuits building these colonies, or are we talking robots?
I don't, again, you're asking, how do you do civil engineering in space? And that's what we don't yet know how to do.
Nobody knows.
But my suspicion is more robots.
Yeah.
There's a very interesting company in California currently making rockets that will compete with SpaceX and Blue Origin.
Yeah.
And they're getting like 95% of their rocket is 3D printed.
Oh, my Lord.
Including all the big tanks and everything.
Good.
So suspicion, don't hold me to it, but my suspicion is it's that sort of technology you'll probably end up using to build them.
Right. Olivia, I think you had a question on alternatives to all this.
So I believe this might be a topic of debate, but wouldn't it be easier to, say, colonize a planetary surface or even like one of the deserts on Earth that are completely uninhabited? It makes more logical sense to stay where we are instead of trying to advance into space.
Do you want to start with that one, Steve?
This is a popular view that we should spend our resources, our time and money sorting out affairs on Earth rather than colonising other planets or colonising space. But that is, in my view, that is an illusion. That's not how that's not what the choice actually
right.
is. What we are looking at when we're talking about living in space is basically the third great transition in human society for millions of years, our ancestors lived in nomadic tribes and lived on a hunting and gathering lifestyle.
Right.
Then about 10,000 years ago, there came the agricultural revolution. It would not have seemed like a revolution at the time, but looking back, we can see that there was a massive change in how humans lived, in that they transferred to agricultural villages. Or in Asia, they were still nomadic tribes, but based on herding specific herds and flocks of animals. Mm. And that was a massive change in the method of human living, and one which enabled a large increase in human population. Then about 250 years ago, the Industrial Revolution, based on using fossil fuels, was a second massive transition in human society because it mechanized in industry and transport, and enabled another huge jump in human population and another massive change in lifestyle, in that the majority of people are now living in cities rather than living as subsistence farmers. And when we're talking about living in space permanently, this is a third great transition, in that the entire life support system needs to be included within the built infrastructure. So there are cities, but there's no longer any agricultural hinterland. Even in Marx's concept, where you have a number of colonies which trade between themselves, it's still true that all the food for the people is grown within a built object, within one of these colonies.
Even if it's a specialist colony that is doing it.
Yeah, a specialist sky farm. And so the result, again, is potentially another massive increase in human population beyond the capacity of Earth itself to the capacity of the solar system.
Just to add, and beyond the capacity of all the planets as well. That's the first argument about why don't you do the planets is, well, there's not enough surface area to have an impact.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. People will live on the planets, but the majority of people will live in space colonies because that is where the material resources are. But can I say that what this means is that if we can live like that in space, then we can live like that on Earth as well. Everybody is pretty much agreed that our civilization here on Earth is unsustainable, that it's using too much natural resources and not recycling them properly. And so even though we have the illusion of sustainability in the developed countries, when you take the planet as a whole, it's just not sustainable in the long term. But my point is that technologies and systems that we need for living in space are the same as those that we need for living sustainably on Earth. And so basically we either get space and Earth as yeah. well as a high-tech society, or else we get neither and revert to a low-tech society. Mm.
So in terms of like a preference over going for a space colony over a planet, does that throw the sci-fi notion of terraforming planets out the window?
I think so. You can't terraform planets in anything, you know, it's typically centuries. I'm not too convinced by people arguing decades. When you look at the scale of human population growth, by the time you finish terraforming Mars, you've solved the problem another way, because it's, you know, it's a century down the line. Human population growth in a century means Mars is not solving you that problem at all.
Right.
And then when you've done it, you're not living on the right gravity. You've destroyed a natural environment that probably, you know, ethically should we be destroying natural environments to that degree? It means no one afterwards can even can appreciate Mars or understand Mars in the way that Mars naturally evolved.
Right.
And you're in the middle of a sucking great big gravitational well that makes it more difficult to get on and off than a space colony, which, as I've just pointed out, it's easier than driving a car off. Rob Parkinson, a friend of ours, did a back in the 80s, did an economic model of a solar system economy. We have a giant sort of model of all the different places.
Yeah.
And he could not find a role for Mars.
Right.
he ended up with a small science station there because there's science to be done there, but he could not find an economic role for Mars.
There's always tourism.
I think that was in the few thousand he had in, sort of, yes, tourism. Yeah. That. But it was an interesting, and he tried because, you know, back in the 80s, and it was, of course, Mars is where we go, and he just could not find a thing to do with it.
I'm sure Elon Musk would disagree.
Yeah, poor Mars.
Yeah. Or lucky Mars, if we're not going to deface it and defame it, yes.
That's true. So I was reading that we could be looking at 700 billion people living in orbits around gas giants or out in the outer solar system or in orbits around Earth. That is 100 times the current Earth population. Do you think that's really feasible?
Can I conceive of it? No. The numbers tell me it can happen. And this is another lesson I've learned from my old friend Alan Bond, is if the numbers are telling you that,
yeah.
and you can't see that in things where your modelling clearly is not at flaw, the numbers are telling you that, then
it's going to happen.
It could happen. We've got to make it happen. It's not just going to happen naturally, but it could. But it could happen.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time. It's really, really fascinating. But there is a $64,000 question here, which is, when can we say to our listeners, this is all going to happen?
Oh, I hate these questions, because the answers are nothing to do with technology. They're nothing to do with natural progress. Tell me when you're going to start, and tell me what funding you're going to give it, and then I'll tell you how long it will take.
There are a lot of young people out there who really want to be able to live in space. They're excited by it.
Yeah, well, then vote for politicians and support people who are on that thing. If you ask me technologically how long it would take to get the early space colonies, probably not as big as you described, but early space colonies, 10,000, 30 years would be safe, maybe even a bit faster.
Only? Wow.
But it won't happen because we're not doing the right things to make it happen.
Right.
Not yet, because not enough people know that it's possible, presumably.
I'm old and grey. I've had a career that's over 40 years, and we have made absolutely no progress in that 40 years to making any of this happen. We've actually gone backwards.
Oh, gosh.
You've got to remember that one of the best launch vehicles in the world at the moment is the Soyuz launch vehicle.
Yeah.
That is the launch vehicle that launched Sputnik 1.
Mm.
In 60 years, trillions of dollars investment in launch vehicles, and it's like the Wright Brothers Flyer is still pretty much the best aircraft you can get. That's how little progress we've made.
But what we're talking about here is huge leaps in science, isn't it? Where the rockets are being incrementally improved. But
no, they're not. That's the point. A, they're not being incrementally improved. We're not... the things that Blue Origin and SpaceX are doing by terms of reusability,
yeah,
they could have been done in the 60s. They could have been done in the 70s.
Yeah.
Now, why hasn't NASA done that? Why hasn't ESA done that? Why has ESA, with Ariane 6, consciously spent $3 to $4 billion developing a new launch vehicle that does exactly the same as Ariane 5, expecting it to compete with Falcon 9 that's got a reusable first stage?
Yeah.
Mm. You know, there is no logic or sense in what we're doing in space at the moment.
Well, you were talking about politics earlier on, I think.
Well, this is what's called Martin's Law. Politics first, money second, technicalities last.
Oh, no.
So just to sum that bit up, we've got possibly small colonies in 30 to 40 years, and the bigger stuff would take, what, 100, 150 years?
No, they'd happen very quickly after.
Would they?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, once you've proven that the colonies are there and can be made, you're going to get a rapid growth to the optimum point because the larger colonies make more economic sense.
I was amazed to see the other day there that Barretts are planning houses on the moon and on Mars.
As the person who designed that house, I can assure you Barretts did not tell me they were actually planning on building them. it was they wanted an exercise which intrigued me, which is how different would it be?
Yeah.
Right.
I learnt a lot, actually, because they gave me the specs for what they do for London flats and things.
Yeah.
And the answer is part of a bit, you know, for air tightness and a bit for some additional safety. Not a lot.
No, they're pretty much the same, are they?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, well, that's good. I mean, you know, as long as we've got the garden for the dog to go out into, that's great.
A dog in a little spacesuit, of course.
Okay.
Sorry, no gardens. You could probably have a dog, but it wasn't. I didn't put a garden in. They didn't put a garden in the spec. I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
Well, there's nowhere to hang your washing, so that's no good.
It truly is mind-boggling, though, that all of that could happen in as little as 30 years if people really put their minds to it.
Yes.
I guess,
I've got to emphasize the caveat.
Yes, of course.
If people put their mind to it, and the evidence is they won't.
Massive if. But say the younger generations wanted to get involved in these sorts of projects. How would you think they could be able to do that? What would be your advice to get young people involved in developments?
To my mind, SpaceX is the model to follow, namely that you form a company that makes a profitable business selling things that people actually want to buy, and that leaves you a profit left over that you can then devote to more visionary things, such as in SpaceX's case colonizing Mars.
So what we want is lots of Googles.
I would actually think Blue Origin are, for my money, working a little better. He's working to get 1 million people into space. His engineering approaches, I think, are a little sounder than SpaceX. So if I were a betting man, obviously I hope they both succeed, but I would give Blue Origin the edge at the moment.
Can I say that from the point of view of the present discussion, that's basically the same model, because Jeff Bezos made his money creating a business selling things that people really wanted, and that gave him the surplus so that he could pursue the visionary activity without depending either on political will or on philanthropy.
I wouldn't disagree with you there. I think one thing that people can do, which is partly what I was expecting Steve to say, is you can join the British Interplanetary Society and join our space team. It's a ridiculous, I wish I hadn't called it that. We have a project called the Space Project, which is actually looking at colonies. And they're doing the team there are doing some really fun work. Steve, do you count yourself as part of that team?
No, I've not been involved.
No, we're around the periphery. We look at their results and we comment on their results. but the
I've corresponded with them.
But the British Interplanetary Society, if you're interested in this sort of thing, is a good place to start.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, certainly back that one. But I can't thank you enough, gentlemen, for joining us here today. The material that you've been talking about is absolutely stunning. And I don't think more than one in a million people have even heard of any of this before now. So hopefully we can get that news around. Hopefully we can get more people to join the British Interplanetary Society and do what they want to do. But in the meantime, thank you very much for joining us and for all your help today. And we'll look forward to seeing you again, hopefully sometime in the future.
It's been a lot of fun. Thanks.
Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you so much.
Yes. And
thanks, Mark.
I hope your viewers will recognize that this whole thing is consistent with looking after Earth. It's not a contradiction to improving our cities on Earth, but it's basically the same technological and societal trends are necessary for both Earth and Mars and space.
So move to Saturn and save Earth.
The two things are consistent.
That's great. Thank you very much indeed. And thank you for all your time today, Stephen and Mark. It's been really brilliant.
It really
has. Thank you very much.
All right, so that's all we have for this flyby. But we've got a great part two coming up with a famous science fiction author, Stephen Baxter, who has a long list of bestsellers to his name, written books with such luminaries as Arthur C. Clarke and Terry Pratchett. And he's going to speak to us about his own views about living in space in these gigantic space colonies. It'll be great, so don't miss it. And we'll look forward to flying with you again next time.